Hey, good morning, everybody. About 231 students, summer session. It's July 27th, and we're in the vascular chapter. And maybe we'll do some other things today. Turn some of these lights down like so. Let's take a look at the schedule. Some important things on the schedule. So today is the 27th. Indeed, we're going to finish up blood vessels today. Maybe get into lymphatic system. Lymphatic system, if I want to do it in a rush, I could probably cover it in 10 minutes. It's not a very big chapter. You'll see that every other word in that chapter is lymph. Lymph this, lymphatic that, lymph node, la-da-da-da. You're going to be tired of that word lymph. But that's a pretty short chapter. Digestive, urinary, diversification, those are really important chapters. So we got a lot of time. Now, there is a mistake on this schedule. Who can tell me what the mistake is on this schedule? Yeah, look at August 5th right here. It says it's a Tuesday, but please be aware it's a Wednesday. Hopefully you don't have to cancel any airline tickets. All right, so it is on Wednesday. And I think that's probably a good thing because that will give you another day, right? And so you have the lecture exam covering these chapters and also the last practicum. And then after that practicum, there's no lab that day, okay? So that's the schedule. I might have a quiz that day, maybe an extra credit quiz or something like that. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody have a question on the schedule? Everybody knows that August 5th is a Wednesday, not a Tuesday. Fantastic. I'll put that away. Had a question about today's quiz. Today's quiz is this figure right here, right? Coronal section of the heart, frontal section of the heart. It is 19.5E. And there's a couple modifications to this. You should know these three blood vessels on the arch of the aorta. So let's go over these blood vessels. What's the first one? And it's going to be on the right, because here's the right ventricle. So the first one, starting on the right side, is it goes to the head and the arm. Head is cephalic, arm is brachio, so this is the brachiocephalic. Remember, we can put words together as long as we put an O between them. Brachiocephalic, there's only one brachiocephalic artery, so we don't have to say right or left, because there is only one. All right, what about the one in the middle? This one goes to the head. That's the head part of the brachiocephalic on the left, but now we're, on the right, brachiocephalic on the right. So here we are looking at the left, and this is the left going to the head, common carotid, a hugely important blood vessel because it brings probably most of the blood to the brain, right? And we want to have a good functioning brain. So here is left common carotid. The next one is the arm part of the brachiocephalic that's on the right. So the arm part is called goes underneath the clavicle, the subclavian. So here is the left subclavian, right? So we got brachiocephalic artery, common carotid, and subclavian. So as a matter of fact, left common carotid and left subclavian. Question? Yeah, B-R-A-C-H-I-O, and then a C-E-F-A-L-I-C, brachiocephalic, yeah. I'm sorry? Yeah, these for the quiz. And so here we have the ascending aorta, here's the arch, and then the descending aorta goes posterior to the heart so you don't see it. But I see a little bit sticking out down over here. What is this vessel sticking out down over here? Descending aorta. What's this little vessel sticking out over here? That is the inferior vena cava, right. Okay, so which way is blood flowing in this inferior vena cava? Toward the heart or away from the heart? Toward or away. Toward, because it is a vein. What about this descending aorta? Artery or vein? Artery, because it's taking blood away from the heart, right? Forget about the colors. The colors just mean whether it's relatively high or low in oxygen. And remember, the pulmonary circulation, starting with the pulmonary trunk, is opposite compared to the systemic circulation that starts with the aorta. So aorta and pulmonary trunk are both arteries. They're just in different circulations. So they're opposite each other, and that's why they got two different colors here. All right, so that's the quiz. And a little bit more, don't forget these layers right here. the quiz for today in lab, not in lecture. All right, so we got down to arteries last time. We took a look at the slide that I'm showing you right now, which are the layers of different blood vessels, right? And on this particular illustration, I see the three main kinds of blood vessels. We have some subcategories of these blood vessels, but this is a really good example of the main ones, and that is we have an artery, right? And we have a capillary, and we have a vein. So I see some arrows in this artery. I see some arrows in this vein. So where would you draw a heart on this figure? Would you draw it here on the left, on the right, on the bottom, on the top? Or where would you draw it to have those arrows make sense? On the top, the bottom, the right, or the left? Just by looking at those arrows. Who's got a sense of what should be? Where would you want to draw it? Mr. V, back there. Okay. Remember, what is an artery? What does it do for blood? It takes blood away or toward the heart? Takes blood away from the heart, right? And here's a vein. What does it do? Bring blood to the heart or take blood away? Brings blood to the heart. So I would draw the heart on top of this illustration, right? That's what would correspond to these arrows the best, right? Okay. So we see a bunch of different layers right here. We notice that arteries contain elastic layers, right? Both in the tunica intima and the tunica media, and there's a much greater muscle layer, thicker muscle layer compared to veins. Veins don't have elastic tissue. They have a much thinner muscular layer as well. All right, so veins can collapse if there's not a lot of blood going into them. They can constrict a little bit and dilate. Right, but the arteries can expand when a big bolus of blood passes through there, when the heart contracts. And what do we call that phase of the heart cycle when the heart is contracting? I talked about that last time, but it's good to know this word. Kind of a strange word. Remember, the heart has two phases to do a cycle. And the part of the heart cycle when the heart is contracting is called, starts with an S. It is systole, and the other part of the heart cycle is when the heart is relaxing, that is diastole. So those are the two phases. Maybe you were always wondering why when you get your blood pressure measured, they give you two numbers. They give you like 120 over 80. What does that mean? That just means that the systolic pressure, the highest pressure, is the first number that somebody tells you, and then the second number is the pressure in an artery during diastole, the lowest pressure. So the pressure in arteries does go up when the heart contracts, starts to decrease when the heart is relaxing, and it would go to zero, but what's a good thing? The heart contracts again and pumps the pressure back up to 120. All right, so that's why you have those two different numbers. And when the heart pumps a big bolus of blood into this particular kind of artery, if it has a lot of elastic tissue, it can blow up like a balloon. And then as that pressure is reduced a little bit, then the elastic fibers bring this blood vessel back down to its normal diameter. And when it does, that helps push blood along as well. Okay. So blood vessels that are very close to the heart have a lot of elastic tissue. Arteries that are far away from the heart don't have so much elastic tissue, and veins do not as well. Right. And we looked at this last time. What is different? Another thing different about an artery and a vein in terms of the structure that I see. For sure, the blood flow is different, right? Toward versus away from the heart. But if you look at this vein, there's something that should stand out. Yeah, there's a valve right here. And the valve is made up of endothelium. Right, so because there's so low a blood pressure in veins, blood will have a tendency to go back down to the periphery away from the heart, but we just said, that violates the principle of a vein. Right, so there are valves that make sure that blood always returns to the heart. Right, even though there might be higher pressure above that valve compared to below, blood is still only going to go back to the heart, not back down to where it came from. So the heart and veins do have valves. The third structure that I see right here is a capillary, and a capillary is really important because you shouldn't think of it as a vessel that takes blood away from the heart. You shouldn't think of it as a vessel that brings blood back to the heart. You should think of it as a blood vessel that does what? Allows for exchange. And on this illustration, it's very obvious the reason is, and that's because look at the thickness of this wall. Capillaries are very thin. Right? So the material can actually diffuse, move from the lumen of a capillary through the wall of the capillary into the interstitial space. For instance, like oxygen, CO2, glucose, various electrolytes, water, right, can move across this capillary. And we're going to see there's actually a couple different kinds of capillaries, and we talk about them in how leaky they are. Some are more leaky than others. All right, so these are the three main types of blood vessels. All right, so arteries, let's go back to this slide over here. Arteries take blood away from the heart. Do you agree with that? In every case, is that true? Is that true for every case? As a matter of fact, it is. Yeah, that's how we define what an artery is. And it may be oxygenated or deoxygenated. Give me the name of an artery that carries relatively low oxygen or is deoxygenated. An artery that does that. I heard pulmonary trunk. That's perfect. You could say any pulmonary artery, including the pulmonary trunk. And probably I would let you even say a pulmonary arteriole. Right, that's down over here. An arteriole is just a small artery. Arteries also have the highest pressure of all the blood vessels in your body because any fluid, whether it is a gas or a liquid, will move according to a pressure gradient. A pressure gradient, just like things will diffuse according to a concentration gradient, but a fluid will flow according to a pressure gradient from high to low, just like diffusion. All right, so we want blood to flow out of arteries. That's why it has high pressure. Veins have low pressure, so blood is going to flow from arteries to veins. Don't forget, elastic. It has elastic layers. Large arteries near the heart are called conducting arteries because they have that large elastic layer. And then some blood vessels that are farther away or arteries that are farther away have a little bit more muscle, thicker muscle. And we call these distributing arteries. So there's a difference between conducting and distributing. Conducting are just big major trunks that carry blood away from the heart, like the aorta, for instance, pulmonary trunk. Okay, some of these muscle layers can also cause vasodilation or vasoconstriction. And the sympathetic nervous system can control vasoconstriction and vasodilation when sympathetic signals get to these blood vessels. Remember, sympathetic stimulation is part of the autonomic nervous system. It's thoracolumbar, right? And it releases norepinephrine from the postganglionic neuron. So it can cause a change in diameter or the radius of these blood vessels. And that's hugely important for the next particular reason. You don't have enough blood to go everywhere in your body at one time. If all the capillaries that we see over here on this illustration were to receive blood, then we would just pass out. We wouldn't have enough blood going to the brain. So our body has to pick where it goes. Like after a meal, it goes to your digestive tract. When you're exercising, it goes to muscles. So what do you think about having a big lunch and exercising at the same time? It's a problem. Right? Because you don't have enough blood to go to both places. And your mom always told you, right after lunch, what could you not do? She wouldn't let you go swimming. Yeah, because you start to exercise as soon as you've had lunch, right? And you might get a muscle cramp because you don't have enough blood going there. And if you're swimming and you get a big cramp, you might not be able to hold your head above water. And then what happens? That's a problem, right? And then you drown. So she was pretty wise when she said that. All right, so what determines, or how does your body control where blood goes? By either vasodilation or vasoconstriction. And here's a really important principle. Small changes in the diameter causes large changes in blood flow through a blood vessel or any kind of tube, as a matter of fact. It's called the fourth power rule. So on this top line, I have the radius of a blood vessel, and I have, let's just measure it and have it be 1 centimeter, and then let's double it to 2, and then let's make it 3, make it 4, make it 5. We're changing the radius of that blood vessel, changing it in centimeters. Now, what's going to happen to the blood flow? Let's just say at 1 centimeter, we can measure it at 1. And if we double the radius, what happens to the blood flow through there? It doesn't change by a factor of 1. It does what? It goes to the fourth power rule, right? So the radius changed by factor 2. What about flow? It's 2 times 2, which is 8, times 2, which is 16. 2 times 2 is 4. Sorry, 2 times 4 is 8. 2 times 8 is 16. So the blood flow changes by a factor of 16, even if the radius of that blood vessel changes a measly factor of 2. All right, so that's what changes blood flow, vasoconstriction or vasodilation. Or let's just say if the radius of a blood vessel dilates 5 times compared to what is over here, look at the blood flow. It changes by a factor of 625. That's a huge increase for a relatively small increase in radius. So vasoconstriction and vasodilation are really important ways that your body can shunt blood from one area of your body to another. Now, there's some organs where that doesn't really happen, like your brain. Maybe vasoconstricts, dilates a little bit in certain circumstances, but usually your brain has all the blood and oxygen it needs. All right, arterioles. They specialize, they regulate blood flow. All right, so how does your body regulate blood flow? By changing the radius of a blood vessel via vasoconstriction and vasodilation. Okay, and sympathetic tone, right? Sympathetic, so arterioles receive sympathetic nerve fibers, and in most cases, when sympathetic nervous system goes to a blood vessel, it causes vasoconstriction. Then here is another important rule. Local control is pretty important. Local control is intrinsic regulator. It does not need a nervous system to adjust blood flow to a particular capillary. So let me draw local control out. I don't think we have something really neat in your book. Local control. So here we have a bunch of cells. All right. Here we have a bunch of cells. And then over here, let's draw the same cells. And then we're going to draw a blood vessel. Sort of a blood vessel here, and another blood vessel here and here. And over here, the first case, we're going to say under resting conditions. And then over here, we're going to say exercise. Under resting conditions, these cells aren't working very hard, right? And so they have all of the oxygen they need. Because this blood vessel is bringing oxygen, they don't need a lot of oxygen. So oxygen concentration is high. And since these cells are not using up oxygen, CO2 levels are relatively low. And since these cells really aren't doing anything, ATP concentration is high. Now let's get these cells working. What happens to these cells when they start working in terms of these three chemicals? They need oxygen, right, to make ATP. So in this particular case, these cells, okay, are using up oxygen and releasing CO2. So CO2 increases, oxygen decreases, ATP starts to go down. And when, for instance, muscles are working, they produce an acid that gets secreted into this interstitial space. Anybody have a sense of when a muscle is working? One reason why muscles start to hurt when you start to work them strenuously? Anybody ever hear of lactic acid? Raise your hand if you've heard of lactic acid. Probably a couple of people have heard of lactic acid, right? And when that lactic acid builds up, that's why muscles hurt even the next day sometimes. So when muscles are working, lactic acid increases. Okay, so under these conditions, these compounds, an increase in CO2, okay, a decrease in ATP, an increase in lactic acid, causes those smooth muscles to relax and dilate this blood vessel. All right, so all of these things go right here, causing vasodilation. No nerves are necessary for this. All right, if oxygen is high and CO2 is low and ATP is high, these chemicals go to the muscles around this blood vessel and cause them to constrict. And so this principle right here, because it doesn't require any nerves, is what we call local control. Local control. So without any kind of nervous system, right, that will work just fine. And that's how blood is regulated to various parts of your body. All right. I'll leave that on the board, but I got to turn these lights off. Okay, so arterioles are particularly good at regulating blood flow via vasoconstriction and vasodilation. Okay, let's look for a nice capillary bed. Ah, here's a really nice capillary bed. Okay, capillaries. Remember, they're specialized for exchange. And here we have a red blood vessel. So this is a systemic artery taking blood away from the heart, even though these arrows are kind of backwards compared to what we saw before. Here's a vein, right, relatively low in oxygen. And here we have some tissues that are surrounded by these tiny, tiny little blood vessels that we call capillaries, really thin. So exchange can take place in these blood vessels. And then here, I see some smooth muscle, some circular smooth muscle. Sometimes that's called a sphincter. A circular smooth muscle that acts as a gate is a sphincter. What do we call a circular skeletal muscle? Everybody's aware of this. What's a circular skeletal muscle you use to close your eyes, close your mouth? That's an orbicularis, right? Orbicularis is a circular skeletal muscle. But a circular smooth muscle, you don't have voluntary control of that, is what we call a sphincter. And we find these sphincters at the entrance to these capillaries. So these are what we call pre-capillary sphincters. These are under local control, not sympathetic or nervous system control. Right, so if oxygen is high, these things constrict. If oxygen is low and CO2 is high, lactic acid is around, then these things dilate. What happens when these smooth muscles dilate? What happens to blood flow? When the diameter increases, blood flow increases according to that fourth power rule, right? A small change in diameter of this precapillary sphincter causes a huge change in blood flow. So if this is a resting tissue, blood gets into this arteriole and goes straight through the capillary bed right back to this vein. Right, so it doesn't spend a lot of time in a capillary network. It just bypasses right through there. Right, when these tissues start to exercise, they use up ATP, produce ADP, lactic acid, and other kinds of things. This is what happens. These precapillary sphincters dilate. Right, and when they dilate, blood rushes through this capillary network that allows for exchange, bringing in oxygen, taking away CO2, getting rid of lactic acid, right? And so that maintains the health of these tissues right here because they need that oxygen. Okay, so sometimes we call this a vascular shunt when the precapillary sphincters are closed, and then we have these capillaries that are actually allowing for exchange when these precapillary sphincters dilate. So that's important thing to know. Controls blood flow via local control only. All right, so these precapillary sphincters, even though they're smooth muscle, they are not innervated by the autonomic nervous system. None whatsoever. Okay, capillaries. The smallest blood vessel in your body? Indeed, that is so. And I see that we have three different kinds of capillaries. All right, so here we have a nice illustration. How could you tell me by looking at this illustration that this is a capillary? Do you believe me when I say capillary, when you're looking at this illustration? I see some people nodding their heads. Why do you think this is a capillary? How would you explain to somebody this is a capillary, not a vein, not an artery? Because here I see a red blood cell, and it looks like there's only one that can fit through this vessel. And that's true. That's kind of a characteristic of a capillary. It's so small that only one blood vessel can go through there. All right. But I want you to know another important reason, according to what we talked about already. And it's really important, and that is layers, the number of layers in this particular vessel. How many layers do you see? I see the endothelium, and that's pretty much it. So there's only a single layer right here of simple squamous cells. Arteries and veins have many, many layers. Capillaries only have this one called the endothelium. And it has some connective tissue around them, which really doesn't impede flow. There are some spaces between the cells of the endothelium, but they're really, really small because there are tight junctions between the cells that kind of glue the cells together. So material can only move from the lumen of a blood vessel to the interstitial space if they move through this particular cell. They have to diffuse through the cell, but it's okay because it's a really thin cell, right? It's a squamous cell. If we see a capillary like this, this is the least permeable capillary. We call it a continuous capillary. Here are some examples of where we find it in skin and muscle. We have some other capillaries where faster and better exchange has to take place to maintain the tissue outside of it. And here is a modification to the endothelium that allows for more exchange. Again, it's a capillary because I just see a simple squamous epithelium. And it still has some tight junctions, right? But there are nice also clefts now between the cells, the intercellular clefts here and here. So these are spaces that allow small molecules just to flow right out of a capillary. There are still some pinocytotic vesicles which are responsible for transport across the cell. Okay, but now we have this intercellular cleft, and we also see some pores within each of the cells of that endothelium. It reminded somebody of windows in these cells, but actually things can move across, and we call these fenestrations. These pores are fenestrations. So that makes this capillary a lot more leaky than this one that doesn't have any intracellular clefts, doesn't have any pores. So this is a fairly leaky capillary. Find these small intestine and kidney. And then there's even one that's a lot more leaky. It's called a sinusoidal capillary. So look at the endothelium here. All right, so we see large intercellular clefts, huge intercellular clefts, not big enough for this red blood cell to fit through, but now sometimes even large molecules can move through these intercellular clefts. There still has to be some tight junctions every once in a while to keep the endothelial cells together. And also the pores, the fenestrations are a lot larger. So a sinusoidal capillary is the most leaky. Kind of strange. Usually I think that when something's in the blood, it doesn't leak out. But here's a particular case in this capillary where things should really leak out. That's really important for lymphatic tissues, right? And the liver, because liver is responsible for cleaning blood, and that blood needs to get out of this capillary, then the liver can clean it up and put it back in the blood vessel. All right, so those are the three kinds: continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal capillaries. The next kind of blood vessel is a venule. That's just a small vein. And these coalesce, they join together to form a vein. And a vein has the lowest blood pressure. And it always brings blood back to the heart. It could be oxygenated or deoxygenated. So I have to ask you, give me an example of a vein that is high in oxygen. High in oxygen. Vein high in oxygen. Which is kind of a strange beast. Okay. Pulmonary vein. Any part of the pulmonary circulation, right? Because it's taking blood away from the lungs toward the heart And what does blood do when it goes to the lungs? It picks up oxygen, right? So that makes perfect sense. Lowest blood pressure, and remember, it has valves. And how does blood in a vein make it back to the heart if veins have very low pressure? As a matter of fact, it might even be zero in some circumstances. How does blood find its way back to the heart? Well, there are a couple pumps that can be activated to bring blood back to the heart. One is called the skeletal muscle pump, and the other is called the respiratory pump. Let's look at the skeletal muscle pump first. So here I see a blood vessel. And remember, an artery could be red or blue. This particular vessel is blue, but we can't tell if it's an artery or a vein because of the color. But it says vein on this illustration. How do you know this is a vein? Just by looking at the anatomy of this blood vessel. Not the artificial color, but the structure. How do you know, and not the arrows, what do you see in this particular blood vessel, which means that it's a vein? Look at this right here. What do we have? A valve. And only veins have valves, right? Capillaries don't have valves like this. They have those sphincters, but not valves. Arteries never have valves. Heart has valves, but not arteries. All right, so here's a valve. And as a matter of fact, right, if you take your arm and pinch it in just the right way, you can actually see these little knots, which are valves, if you cause this muscle to contract. So here is a vein going through a muscle. When the muscle contracts, it bulges up, right, and it squishes down on this segment of a vein, increasing the pressure, right? So if you were to take a balloon and squeeze down on a balloon, the pressure would increase. That's what happens with this little segment of a vein. And why is it that when this segment right here gets pressurized, why does blood flow back to the heart and not back down to the periphery? Because the superior valve opens up, the inferior one right here closes, and so blood can't return to the periphery. It can only move toward the heart. And so maybe I would want to say proximal and distal valve right here with respect to the heart. That's maybe a better way of saying it. All right, so when skeletal muscles contract, that helps return blood to the heart. When skeletal muscles don't contract, blood has a harder time getting back to the heart. And blood will have a tendency to stay in these areas and stop flowing. I think I've mentioned what happens to blood. Blood's a living tissue, right? It's a connective tissue. What happens to blood when it stops flowing? I think I mentioned this to us. It has a tendency. Normally, it's a fluid. But when it stops flowing, what does it have a tendency to do? It has a tendency to coagulate or form a clot, right? So that is terrible when that happens. So now you have blood clot going back to the heart, right? That can cause a heart attack, a stroke, or pulmonary embolism, right? If that clot goes into the lungs, which is the more likely scenario. So muscle activity or any kind of activity is really important to get blood going back to the heart. Some people get blood clots, okay, when they hop on an airplane and they stay on the airplane for like 16 or 18 hours, like they fly from here to Australia, Denpasar, Indonesia, right, really, really long distance, and they don't get up out of their seat, then this blood, since these muscles aren't working, doesn't return to the heart, forms a blood clot, which then can travel to their lungs. And so if you're ever sitting for a long period of time, not as long as an anatomy lecture, but a really long period of time, like 8-10 hours without moving at all, even much worse if it's longer than 10 hours, you should get up and exercise a little bit and get that blood recirculating. So it is true that exercise helps circulation, improves circulation. So that's important. So this is what we call the skeletal muscle pump. Where do we have that? Skeletal muscle pump, right? And there is also something else called the respiratory pump. I don't have a slide showing this, okay? But what part of your body acts like a vacuum cleaner? Have you ever thought of any part of your body as a vacuum cleaner? I just saw somebody take a breath, okay? So your lungs, your thoracic cavity is a vacuum cleaner, right? When you exercise muscles to increase the volume of your thoracic cavity, the pressure decreases in your lungs. It stays constant in the air around you. And when pressure is low in your lungs and high in the air, guess which way air is going to flow? From high to low. So air is going to flow from your surrounding into your lungs. That's how air gets in your lungs. But not only, so your thorax is acting like a vacuum cleaner. But when you inhale, not only is air flowing into your lungs, but other fluid as well, like blood in veins. Whenever you take a breath, that helps suck blood from the periphery up toward the heart as well. Okay? And then when you exhale, when you force air out of your lungs, that forces blood out of the thoracic cavity back down to the periphery, but there's something that stops that from happening. When you exhale, pressurizing your thorax, that's going to press venous blood out of your thorax. But what prevents that from happening? What does a valve have? It's got a special structure that prevents that retrograde flow of blood. It's called a valve, right? So when you inhale, blood gets sucked up into your thoracic cavity. When you exhale, it can't go back because of those valves right there. So that's what's important about these valves. And if there's disease of these valves, it causes huge problems for patients, like deep venous thrombosis, for instance. Okay. Who's got a question on any of that kind of stuff? Anybody? Okay. Let's go back to the schedule real quick. I see some students come in that missed this announcement. I just want to make sure that you are aware that next week, on August 5th, right, we're going to have a lecture exam and a practicum the same day. But on that day, August 5th, it is not a Tuesday. It is a Wednesday, right? So you get an extra day. That should be good news for you. So Wednesday, August 5th is the last day of this class. Okay, I'll probably mention that another couple times. And if I do, you can start booing or hissing or whatever. And then I'll know for sure you know that. Okay, I don't want anybody to be surprised. Pulmonary circulation. Well, to know something about the pulmonary circulation, here's a pretty good slide of the pulmonary circulation. Right? Pulmonary circulation receives blood from the right ventricle, right? So here's the right side of the heart. Here's the left side. So how many sides does the heart have? Two. How many circulations are there? Two. That's right. So the right side starts the circulation for the pulmonary circulation, which goes to the lungs. And I see some nice lungs. So here is a pulmonary trunk taking blood away from the heart. So that's an artery. Right? And don't forget, pulmonary trunk is the most anterior great vessel coming off the base of the heart. That's the first one that you're always going to see. Then behind that is the aorta. But I don't want to talk about the aorta because it's not part of the pulmonary circulation. So here's the pulmonary trunk bifurcating pretty quickly into the right and left pulmonary arteries. The right pulmonary artery goes right underneath the arch of the aorta. It gets tucked away over here before it gets to the right lung. All right, so all of these blue blood vessels that you see. So what would you call this thing where I have the cursor right now on this blue blood vessel? What kind of blood vessel is that? It's a pulmonary blood vessel, but you got to be a little bit more specific. It is that an artery or a vein? Okay, kind of looks like a vein because it's blue. But don't forget, this is the pulmonary circulation. Pulmonary circulation is opposite to the systemic, so this blue blood vessel, right, you're right, is low in oxygen, but it is an artery because this is bringing blood to the lung to pick up oxygen. That's why it's relatively low. So pulmonary arteries are low in oxygen. They go to capillaries where, oh look, here's a capillary, pulmonary capillary. CO2 goes into, these right here are little spaces in the lungs called alveoli. They're filled with air, high in oxygen, low in CO2. So when this capillary has blood going near these spaces, CO2 leaves the blood, and what enters the blood is oxygen. And now this capillary empties into a vein, which is high in oxygen. So if I put the cursor on this red vessel right here, that's a pulmonary vessel, but what kind? Artery or vein? You should be able to draw an arrow in. Right? Is it bringing blood toward the heart or away from the heart? This vessel that's high in oxygen. Well, you can trace it back. It's bringing blood back to the heart. So this is a pulmonary vein. A pulmonary vein is high in oxygen because it's coming back from the lung. And that's what it does in the lung. It picks up oxygen. So blue blood vessels in the pulmonary circulation are arteries. Red blood vessels in the pulmonary circulation are veins. Opposite compared to the systemic circulation. Okay, so that's all I want to say about pulmonary circulation. Otherwise, one thing, maybe one last thing, the pressure that's used to drive blood through the lungs, since the lungs are a very small volume compared to your body, is not a really tough job for the heart. Heart has a really easy time pumping blood through the lungs. So what can you tell me about the right ventricle in terms of the musculature of the right ventricle compared to the left? The right ventricle, here's the right ventricle. Since it has a relatively easy job, these muscles are relatively thin. The left ventricle is the beginning of the systemic circulation. The left ventricle has a much harder job pushing blood through the whole body, the rest of the body. And so look at the muscle wall. Can you see it's a lot thicker? The left ventricle is a lot thicker compared to the right ventricle in the normal heart. Right, so we're always going to look at a normal situation, unless I mention otherwise. Okay. Well, let's take a look at some branches. Right, and there's a couple of things that we don't cover in lab. Most of these things we cover in lab. Okay. So let's switch from pulmonary circulation to systemic circulation. Here's a pretty good picture of the whole systemic circulation, which might be a little bit complicated, but let's see if I can zoom in without losing too much resolution. Okay, it's a little... Okay, a little grainy, but not too bad. Okay, so the anterior longitudinal sulcus is going to be right about here. This illustration is okay, but it's not great because I would like to move this thing over a little bit. So here is the right ventricle, here's the left, and we're interested in the systemic circulation, and I see the aorta. And now I'm wondering, are we looking at the systemic circulation or the pulmonary circulation if we're looking at the aorta? Systemic or pulmonary? Yeah, systemic circulation, right? Because for pulmonary circulation, you'd start with the pulmonary trunk. So aorta is the first part, the most proximal part of the systemic circulation. Here is a division where the aorta ascends from the base of the heart. So we call this the ascending division of the aorta. And then here is the arch where it makes a 180 degree bend. And then I see the descending aorta. Right. And here's the diaphragm. So what do we call this cavity? Superior to the diaphragm. This whole cavity, not just the pericardial cavity, but this whole cavity right here. This is the thoracic cavity. That's right. So this part of the descending aorta that's in the thoracic cavity, right, is called the thoracic division of the descending aorta because it's in the thoracic cavity. When it goes through the diaphragm, it's still descending aorta, but now it's the abdominal region of the descending aorta. And if we follow it down into the pelvic cavity, we don't see it anymore because it bifurcates into two other arteries, which we're going to look at in just a second. All right, so what are the divisions of the aorta? You've got ascending, arch, descending, which I see here, and the descending has two divisions, the thoracic and abdominal division. That's the aorta. That's what brings blood to most of your body, except the heart. What kind of circulation brings blood to the heart? I think we talked about that when we looked at the heart. What do we call those blood vessels that bring blood to the heart or take blood away from the heart? It's called the coronary circulation. And the right and left coronary arteries come off of the ascending aorta, really close to the aortic semilunar valve, so close that we can't even see it on this illustration. All right, so let's trace some of these blood vessels. I'm going to move it down a little bit. Oh, this is nice. Okay, so those are the coronaries, the first blood vessels off the aorta. The second blood branch off the aorta is the Let's run through these. Number 1, 2, and 3. What's number 1? brachiocephalic, right? And it's not right or left, there's only one. And then here's one, number two, going to the head, that is the common carotid. And as a matter of fact, if you said left, that's beautiful, left common carotid. The third one is the left, look, going underneath the clavicle, left subclavian, right? So we got brachiocephalic, common carotid, subclavian, in that order. Brachiocephalic doesn't go a very long distance when it bifurcates, right, into the right common carotid, which is comparable to the left one over here, and the right subclavian. So brachiocephalic is really doing the job of what? The left common carotid and the left subclavian together, right? Okay. All right. The common carotid bifurcates pretty early on in your neck, and it bifurcates into an external carotid, which brings blood to external features on your skull, like your face and your scalp, and an internal carotid. Internal carotid goes through, what bone is that? A temporal bone, goes through the temporal bone, and brings blood to the brain. And see this, what is this? If you look at this area right here, it reminds me of a letter of the alphabet. What does that remind you of? A Y. That's right. All right, so that Y is what we call a bifurcation. And this is not labeled in your anatomy textbook, and that's a huge mistake, right? So you should know what this area is, this Y. Notice that there's like a little bulge right here. So it's at the confluence of the common carotid, internal and external carotid. This is called the carotid sinus. Carotid sinus. S-I-N-U-S. Right? And unfortunately, because of the shape of this carotid sinus and the high pressure, this is the most commonly damaged blood vessel in your body. Right? It has a tendency to become damaged. It forms plaques. Right? And those plaques can break away from the wall of this blood vessel. And where can they go? They form a thrombus, almost like a blood clot. Where do they go? When something like this breaks away from the carotid sinus, where does that thrombus go? It goes either to your face, right, and kills some part of your face, or even worse, it can go via the internal carotid to the brain, and that causes a stroke, right? And probably as we get older, we all have damage to this carotid sinus to some degree. In some people, they get it really bad, and it causes stroke. So this is probably the most frequently imaged of all places on the human body, and it's done by ultrasound. And there are people in radiology ultrasound division that just take ultrasounds of people's necks all day long looking for disease of the carotid sinus, because if you can find that early, you might be able to prevent a stroke, and that would be wonderful, right? Nobody wants a stroke. Okay, or even if you get some kind of muscular disease of this area. So carotid sinus, that's important. Okay, so this is all part of the systemic circulation. Let's zoom back out a little bit. Let's trace some blood vessels. I don't care if we go right or left. Now the circulation pretty much stays the same. Let's go to the left side. So we got subclavian as it passes through the axillary region of your body. Right, it's the same blood vessel compared to the subclavian, but it's in a different region, so we want to give it a different name. That's called the axillary. And then when that same blood vessel courses down into the arm, then that's the brachial. And then, right, when it gets to the forearm, look what we got. We got a blood vessel going down the and this is medial, right? So here is the ulnar, and then here is the radial artery. And right here, the radial artery becomes very superficial. Let's zoom in, right? And it goes right over the radius, that big thick region of the radius, the distal epiphysis of the radius. And this is the artery that's very easy to palpate, right? We can actually feel pulses of blood flowing down through the radial artery, and you can count somebody's heart rate very easily here. Usually, if it's a normal person. And we can get somebody's heart rate, and that's sometimes why we call this the radial pulse, when we count somebody's pulse right here. Then we got some palmar arches, right? When the ulnar and radial artery join together, and then they bring blood to the digits and the rest of the hand, digital arteries. Okay, so that's important for the important things for the systemic circulation. As an introduction, let's go back up to the head. Okay, because I made a big deal of this, and look, it's still not labeled on this illustration, and I want you to be able to label this. All right, so here is the arch. Here's the first branch off the arch of the aorta, which is what we call the brachiocephalic artery, and that's on the right side. And then here is the common carotid, bringing blood up to the head. Then here is the external, and then the internal. Oh, look how big that internal carotid artery looks. Nice, right? Because it's bringing blood to your brain. And then this area that has that funny little bulge to it, that's called the carotid sinus, right? The carotid sinus is also important because there are pressure receptors there that are used to regulate your blood pressure. There are also chemoreceptors in the carotid sinus, which help regulate your breathing rate and other things in your body. So not only is it important because it is diseased frequently, but also because it monitors very important states that your body can be in. All right, so that's the carotid. That's all I want you to know about that. None of these other blood vessels. Then, right, after that bifurcation into the common carotid and subclavian, look at this first branch. Where does that look like it's going? So let me zoom in. I'm going to lose the arrow, but that's okay. Whoa, zoomed way in. All right, so here's that first branch. All right, what vertebrae do we see here in the neck? What kind of vertebrae are those? Cervical. What's a characteristic of cervical vertebrae and only cervical vertebrae? Transverse foramina. Do you see any transverse foramina? And now you can see the reason why it's there. Because there's a blood vessel that goes through the transverse foramina, bringing some more blood to the brain. And you always want good blood going to the brain, right? This is called the vertebral artery, right, going through the transverse foramina. So that is an important thing that I want you to know. And then here's a continuation of the subclavian to the axillary. Right, so those are the only vessels that I want you to know on this particular illustration. Oh, look at that pretty picture. Here's an angiogram, right, of blood vessels in the brain. All the other tissues kind of have been, they're not highlighted, but here we can see blood vessels going to the brain. That's what we call an angiograph. Okay, here's a view going back to the brain. Okay, of that ventral surface of the brain. So here are temporal lobes, right? Here is the two frontal lobes. Here's the olfactory bulb, right? And I've got medulla, spinal cord down over here. Okay, so what were the two arteries that we were just looking at that go through the transverse foramina and those cervical vertebrae? Those were the vertebral arteries. So here I see the two vertebral arteries, and then they join together. They call that anastomose. They join together to bring blood to what we call the basilar artery. So here's the basilar. And that's kind of interesting because the basilar is going to bring a lot of blood to the brain. And if there is damage to the right vertebral artery, it's not really too bad because the left vertebral artery can still bring blood to the basilar. Right, so the basilar can get blood from either one of these vertebral arteries, even if one is completely occluded. And that will still bring blood to the brain. All right, so two arteries that bring blood to the brain are the vertebral, and then there's only two more that can do that. And those are the internal carotid. So here's one here, and here's one over here. Remember, this comes from the carotid sinus, the bifurcation of the common carotid to the internal and external. So that's where it hooks up right here. And if we look at the basilar and the common and the internal carotids, I see a ring. I see a circle right here. That's a really important circle. It's a plexus. You can think of this almost as a nerve plexus. And blood gets into, this is what we call the circle of Willis, gets into the circle of Willis from both vertebral arteries and both internal carotids. So if there is damage to any of these blood vessels, that's okay because the other blood vessels can maintain flow to the circle of Willis, which then distributes that blood throughout the brain. All right, so blood can take alternate routes to get to your brain if there's damage to one or maybe even more of these blood vessels. All right, but when these blood vessels are all damaged, partial occlusions, then that's what causes ischemic attacks in the brain. People lose consciousness or they forget who they are, where they are. Okay, and then we got to figure out what to do with those people. Right, so blood can get to the brain, right, the whole brain, not just the right or left side, right, from the two vertebrals and the two internal carotids. So this is an important circle. We call the circle of Willis, and it's got a couple pieces. Let's start tracing it with the basilar. So here's the basilar. That brings blood to this posterior communicating, right? So here is it's posterior to the internal carotid, right? And then from there, we have the anterior cerebral artery. So we got the posterior communicating, right? And then the anterior cerebral artery. And then there's a little interconnection. And then here is the anterior communicating. So we have a posterior communicating and an anterior communicating artery that help form this circle of Willis. And if blood is in any place right here in the circle of Willis, it can then find its way to any part of the brain. So that's an advantage. That's a way to circumvent damage to a blood vessel or partial damages to a couple blood vessels. Okay, so that's what I have right here. Anastomosis to form the circle of Willis. Subclavian, we went through all of this. Okay, I do want you to look at that abdominal division of the descending aorta. Where's a nice picture of the abdominal division of the descending aorta? Maybe right here. Yeah, that's okay. That's it, but way too complicated. I like this one. Okay. So are we looking at the abdominal division? Here I see descending aorta before it bifurcates into the common iliacs. And how do we know this is the abdominal region? How would you find out? How would you convince somebody? What separates the thorax from the abdominal cavity? The diaphragm. And look what we got right here. Diaphragm, right? So inferior to the diaphragm has got to be the abdominal cavity. Okay, let's look at some branches. I do want you to know some branches off the descending abdominal division of the aorta. And when we do that, let's look at the word slide over here. Okay, it's really nice to break these branches off the abdominal aorta into unpaired blood vessels versus paired blood vessels. All right, paired visceral branches go to organs that you have two of. Could you give me an example of an organ? We haven't studied this stuff yet, so it's going to be tough maybe. But could you give me an example of organs that you have in your abdominal cavity or really close to your abdominal cavity that you have two of? And I see it right here. Nice. Two kidneys. Two adrenal glands. Okay. Two gonads. Ooh, what's a gonad? That's not in an abdominal cavity, but close. Pelvic cavity or scrotum, depending, right? You got two of those. So there should be paired branches to gonads, right? Which are what? Either ovary or testes, right? Okay, so let's go over the paired branches first. And then we're going to look at some unpaired branches. Unpaired branches go to organs that you only have one of. Go ahead, give me an example of an organ you only have one of. You only have, even though you get really, really hungry sometimes, like right now, you still only have one stomach, right? You got one liver. You got one small intestine. Those get blood from an unpaired branch of an artery off the abdominal division of the descending aorta. All right, so I promised you paired branches first. So we come down over here. We forget that because that's just a single branch coming off. All right, then we get down over here, and I see a blood vessel going to the right adrenal gland, and I see one going to the left adrenal gland, so that's a paired branch, right? So that's what we call a suprarenal artery or adrenal artery going to adrenal gland. Then here I see a big artery going to the right and left kidney. There are two arteries that do that, and so those are the renal arteries. Renal and kidney mean the same thing. Guess what supra and suprarenal means? Supra means on top of, right, like the adrenal glands. All right, so we have adrenal, we've got renal, and then over here I see the gonadal arteries. And they go all the way down into the pelvic cavity or scrotum. They've got a long way to go. And you might ask me, why are these arteries so positioned here when they got to go such a long distance down into the scrotum? Well, there's some evolutionary significance to that, which we won't get into. Okay, but those are the gonadal. Are they labeled? Oh, yeah, gonadal arteries. Those are the only paired branches, right? The suprarenal, renal, and gonadal. There's only three. What do I have on the slide over here? Abdominal, paired, renal, gonadal, suprarenal, just those three. All right, so now we want to look at some unpaired branches. The first one that's closest to the diaphragm, we call this the celiac trunk, right? A trunk is just a blood vessel which a bunch of branches can come off of. Celiac trunk. The next one, here's an unpaired branch. This is a superior mesenteric. And then one more down over here, this is the inferior mesenteric. So we got three more blood vessels, celiac trunk, superior, and inferior mesenteric, and that's what I have on your list right here. So that's not too bad if you break it down into those two components. All right, so I can put that away. Let's look at a lower extremity, starting with, how does this look? Not bad. Okay, what blood vessels do you have to know here? Not too many. All right, but here is the abdominal division of the descending aorta. Right, it bifurcates into the common iliac. Right, and then it bifurcates again to an external and an internal iliac. Right, external and internal. And then the same blood vessel courses down into the thigh. What do we call the thigh region? That's the femoral region, right? So here is the femoral artery. Look how big that artery is, right? Big, huge blood vessel. And then when it goes behind the knee, we call that the popliteal artery. And I think that's all I want you to know. Femoral, popliteal, behind the knee. That's posterior. So it's not behind the kneecap, it's actually behind your knee. Popliteal. So here we see that femoral artery. When you fracture this femur, it can lacerate the femoral artery, and that's really dangerous. People can die when that happens. Okay, so that's a big, important blood vessel. Okay, veins pretty much are named after the arteries, right, or the same body region, only with a few circumstances. So if you have a radial artery, you have a radial vein. Okay. One example where they won't be the same, you do not have a jugular artery. You have a carotid artery. All right, so a jugular vein is bringing blood back down from the brain to the superior vena cava. So let's just see if we can find a couple of these veins around here to look at. Okay, nice. All right, so this is systemic circulation. Systemic circulation, veins are color-coded blue. Right, so they're going back. So here's the superior vena cava. Here is the jugular. Here's the internal jugular vein bringing blood from the whole head. Jugular. Here's a subclavian vein. When the subclavian and jugular join together, we call that anastomose. Let's zoom in. Zoom into this region here. Zoom, 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 zoom. Ah, nice. Okay, so here's subclavian vein. Here's jugular, internal jugular vein. When they join together, this becomes a brachiocephalic because it's getting blood from the head and the arm, right? Brachiocephalic. And this is on the right side of the body. There's going to be another brachiocephalic, so we got to say right brachiocephalic in this particular case. All right, so let me zoom back out a little bit. Jugular, subclavian joint together. Here's a brachiocephalic vein. This is on the right side of the body. And then, here is the superior vena cava. there's going to be another blood vessel coming in right here, joining, and that's going to be the left brachiocephalic. Let me see if I can find that left brachiocephalic. Not bad. Okay, so here's what we were looking at before. Okay, the subclavian vein, internal carotid, when they join together, that forms the right brachiocephalic, right underneath the clavicle right here, so we can't see it very well. But on the left side, here is the left internal jugular, here's the left subclavian. When they join together, this segment right here is also called a brachiocephalic vein, right? Coming from the head and from the arm. So this would be the left brachiocephalic. Left brachiocephalic is a lot longer than the right brachiocephalic, just because the left brachiocephalic has to go a longer distance to get to the superior vena cava, which takes blood. Where does the superior vena cava bring blood to? I want to see if anybody is awake. Anybody still awake? Where does the superior vena cava bring blood to? You all know. Okay, it is the right atrium, the right atrium on the right side of the heart. Okay. Okay. The last thing I want to talk about is a portal circulation. And when we think of a circulation, what kind of blood vessels are normally involved? What do we have? Here's a typical circulation. What do you see on this slide? Taking blood away from the heart is an artery. A blood vessel that allows for exchange is a capillary. And then a blood vessel that brings blood back to the heart is a vein. Right? See, this is a typical circulation. Artery, capillary, vein. But a couple places in your body, this scheme, all right, is modified. Instead of having one capillary bed, there are two, back to back, with another blood vessel in between them, and that's called a portal circulation. All right, so a portal circulation is very special. You don't have too many of these in your body, but there's a couple places. And one of the places is where it goes to the liver. All right, so does this look a little bit different to you? Because I see one capillary bed and then a second capillary bed in a different part of the body connected via this portal blood vessel. And we've actually seen a portal blood vessel before. Can anybody remember where we saw a portal blood vessel? Between what two parts of your body? One part was the brain. The other part was the anterior pituitary. Remember the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal vein between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary? And this is the same thing. So here we have an artery. First capillary bed number one, this capillary is going to be in the stomach and intestine. It picks up nutrients or whatever you've eaten or drunk from your digestive tract, including a bunch of toxins, right? Get picked up by the blood. These toxins could affect our brain, affect our physiology in a nice, in a bad, negative way. So instead of dumping all these toxins back into our systemic venous system, it goes via this portal blood vessel to the vein, I mean to the liver, right? So here's the hepatic portal vein, to the liver where there's another capillary bed, and these capillaries here in the liver are very leaky. So a lot of fluid leaks out of this capillary and the toxins are detoxified by liver cells, all right, before they're delivered via the hepatic vein back to the inferior vena cava. So here is a nice scheme for a portal blood vessel. Capillary bed number one, capillary bed number two, and a portal blood vessel that connects the two. So here is the whole scheme for the hepatic portal system. Okay, so we have the gastric vein coming from the stomach, superior mesenteric from small intestine, inferior mesenteric from small intestine and large intestine, splenic vein from the spleen. This blood doesn't get returned to the systemic venous system right away. It goes into the hepatic portal vein, which is this thing right here. It goes through capillaries. That's a capillary bed number two in the liver. And then it gets into a hepatic vein, inferior vena cava, back to the right atrium. So So here is that hepatic portal vein, and there are capillaries, right, that feed blood to all these veins, gastric, superior, inferior mesenteric, and splenic vein. Okay, fetal circulation, I think we're going to review in lab today. So I don't want to talk about it in lecture. Maybe I'll just find something that reminds me of fetal circulation. Your picture in your book has this and also the adult circulation at the same time. So when we look at this figure, okay, I see some lungs right here. They're kind of grayed out. And this liver is kind of grayed out. So this is an illustration of a body of a fetus. Now, where do we find a fetus? Where is it living? Outside world? No, inside somebody's uterus, right? All right, so what about a fetus? Are they breathing air? Is a fetus breathing air? They are not. So what about their lungs? Do they need to have functional lungs? They do not, right? So a fetus does not have functioning lungs. They don't really have a functioning liver or functioning kidney. So how do they get oxygen into their body? They get it via the placenta. So here's the placenta. The placenta is doing the job of the lungs. That's pretty much how I want you to think of it. All right, so here is the special fetal circulation. The placenta, how should you think of the placenta as being the lungs for the fetus, right? And what can you tell me about the circulation of the pulmonary circulation in the adult compared to systemic? Are they exactly the same? They're pretty much opposite each other. So when we look at the fetal circulation, I want you to think of it as the pulmonary circulation in the adult because it's doing the job of the lungs, right? So blood that is going to the placenta is like the pulmonary artery, which is what? Low in oxygen. So the placental, or what we call umbilical artery, is low in oxygen, picks up oxygen in the placenta. So this red blood vessel that is high in oxygen is the umbilical vein, just like pulmonary veins are high in oxygen. All right, so this is just a little bit of a review or introduction to fetal circulation that we'll look at in lab. Okay, let me talk about one other thing. What ventricle pumps blood to the lungs in the adult? Is it the right or the left? It's the right ventricle, right? Right ventricle pumps blood into the pulmonary trunk, which then goes to the lungs. Well, in the fetus, right, we don't want to have a lot of blood being pumped to the lungs. It's all wasted energy. So there are ways that blood can circumvent going to the lungs. There's a hole in the heart between the atria, between the right and left atrium. And that's called the foramen ovale. You have to kind of know what its counterpart in the adult is for the quiz. That's called the fossa ovalis. Well, when blood returns to the right atrium, instead of going to the lungs via the right ventricle, it skips right into the left ventricle, and then where does it go? Systemic circulation, right, bypassing the lungs. There's something else. If some blood does get into the right ventricle and pumped into the pulmonary trunk, oh, I got to zoom in, into the pulmonary trunk, okay, some can go to the lungs, but a lot can also go through this extra blood vessel right here, right? This is called the ductus arteriosus. It connects the pulmonary trunk with the aorta. And when blood goes from the pulmonary trunk directly into the aorta via this ductus arteriosus, right, it bypasses the lungs. And that's a very good circulation to have for a fetus. Not so good if you're an adult, okay, because then blood is bypassing the lungs and your arterial blood is not well oxygenated. And your body might have a certain kind of color to it if blood isn't oxygenated, if this foramen doesn't close, or this ductus arteriosus doesn't close, what color is your body going to turn if blood isn't going to the lungs, picking up oxygen? You're going to become cyanotic or have a blue color to you, right? So as soon as somebody's born, that's one of the things that they look at right away, right, is color of skin. If they're jaundice, right, or if they're cyanotic, That's something that's part of a measure of how viable that newborn baby is, right? And does anybody know what that score is called? It's called an Apgar score, right? As soon as somebody sees you, as soon as you're born, you're given an Apgar score to evaluate how viable you are. And if you're in a little jeopardy, it could be due to a number of different things. And then somebody's got to figure out right away what's going wrong, right, to save that infant's life. Okay, if you're cyanotic, that reduces your Apgar score. So one of the things you might consider right away is that there is a hole in the heart that didn't close, right? Or this ductus arteriosus didn't close. Or there's some other malformation in these great blood vessels at the base of the heart, and then somebody's going to yell out, we need a scan of the mediastinum right away to see what these connections are in that newborn baby. Okay, so that's it for lecture today. We're going to keep talking about this fetal circulation, but I wanted to introduce that to you a little bit before we get to lab upstairs. Okay, what's the last day of school? Wednesday. Yes, thank you. Not this week, next week.